Welcome back, our dear listeners, to another enlightening episode of South Sudan and the World, where we delve into conversations with remarkable individuals shaping the landscape of South Sudan and beyond. I am your host, Akol Dog, and today we're honored to have a distinguished guest with us. Joining us today is Nyajok Tomyik, a multifaceted individual who has left a remarkable mark in various spheres of life. A mother of three, a retired army nurse, an accomplished author, a community organizer, a mentor, and a nonprofit leader, a successful entrepreneur, and an unwavering advocate for women's rights, girl-child education, family planning. He is the visionary founder of I Am Nyatonyik Foundation, providing essential mental health services, counseling, mental and legal aid, and educational resources to members of the South Sudanese community worldwide through her Ross Girls Initiative. Nyajo, welcome to the show. Thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you, Akol. It's an honor to be here. Thank you so much for having me.
So you've worn many hats in your life, as I said, with what you're doing now. You have a lot on your plate. You're working, you're traveling, you're doing your book, you work. Give us a background. Where did this all start? Could you share with our listeners a glimpse of your upbringing, your childhood?
Of course, yes. So, like I call it, my name is Nyajok Tomyik. I am from South Sudan, Upper Nile. I grew up in I was born in Maywood County. You know, like many of us are called, we really didn't grow up, especially our age and, you know, we didn't grow up in South Sudan because of the civil war. So my family were in Eton refugee camp for a brief, short moment. And then they moved to Dima refugee camp, where my childhood memories really began, was in Dima. And then 26 years ago, we migrated here to the U.S. under the immigration services. So I grew up here in Dima in Ethiopia. I'm currently now from Omaha, Nebraska. And as you know, I joined military right out of nursing school in 2009, was in the army for 11 years. And now, since I was medically retired from the military, I now do travel nursing, raising my children. But with all of that, you know, I like to do other things than aside from my main career, nursing. So I got into real estate in 2016. So I started flipping homes, I started learning about being debt-free, things like that. And I soon realized, as much as I love nursing, I also love real estate. My facet for learning about building stream of income I became obsessive about being debt-free. So I made some programs, I got out of debt. Now I own two homes, I travel, and this is just part of me. 3 years ago, you know, I launched IMI Mother Wallace Dream. I published my book and we went on a book tour. So that's just a little bit about me. I do love to be here and there and advocating for women like myself that have been through a lot, be the culture influence and just norms that are oppressing young women.
This is an interesting story. Mm-hmm. Now, your career is in nursing. What sparked your interest in nursing? How did you get into nursing?
This is really funny because growing up, especially in Ethiopia, there was no such thing as nursing, right? You never hear nursing. So a very young kid, I wanted to be a pediatrician doctor. I think a lot of women especially want to be pediatrician doctors. So I wanted to be a pediatrician. I went to college, studied biology. So during my second term of college, I was taking a class called medical terminology. So we were sent into hospitals to shadow doctors to just see what they do. You know, give us a glimpse of their life on a daily basis and see, that's what we want to do. And, you know, I found myself at a nursing station. I was sitting down and there was this older woman, you know, I was in my early 20s. I can say she's an older woman. And I asked her, I said, what do you do? What is your job? She's like, oh, I'm a nurse. I'm like, what is a nurse? And she started telling me about what she do on a daily basis. So all I see, the doctors I was supposed to shadow, he was gone, going from patient room to the patient room. And I'm right here talking to a nurse at a nursing station about what she does. And I told her, I said, well, I want to go back to my country one day and open a clinic. And she said, you can be a nurse practitioner. You know, I said, what is a nurse practitioner? So she started explaining to me. I came back to college and I went to my advisor and I said, I want to be a nurse. And that's how I changed my major. So here I am, you know, almost 16 years now, I'm a nurse.
So it was more of a calling. It was just like, okay, this is in line with what I want to do. Let me go ahead and do that.
Yeah, I think I didn't have an option to sit down with a doctor really to tell me what they do besides what you think they do. But this woman really took her time to explain to me what she does on a daily basis. And it really clicked with me. You know, I'm a very people person. I didn't want to just spend 5 minutes with a patient and say, okay, here's your medication. I really wanted to get to know them. I want to know how many kids they have. I want to know about their background. And, you know, you don't see doctors getting to do that because they don't have time. But as nurses, we stay with our patients for 24 hours. So we definitely get to know them. And I feel like that was more of what I wanted to do, to get to know my patient on a personal level.
So you got into the nursing, and then from there, you got into nonprofit. How did you go from nursing into nonprofit?
Again, I had no knowledge about nursing, about a nonprofit. That is probably my newest adventure, is the nonprofit. You know, that was found right after the book was launched. The book was launched in 2022. We went on a book tour, and we started out in Kenya. And while we were in Kenya, and even before the book tour, the sales online were amazing. The review off the roof. People were making videos and posting it on social media. So people were reading the book and they were sharing their own experiences from what they read in the book. So when the book tour happened, my book editor and my friend and co-founder Camille Thomas and I were traveling. Her mother is a nonprofit organization founder and writer for grants. So when she saw us doing these things in Africa, she called me and she said, "Najok, you're going to need a nonprofit." I said, "What do you mean?" She said, "What you're doing right now, it needs to be recorded. It needs to channel toward a particular goal, you know? Because we were just going to talk about the book, to talk about my experience and, you know, selling the book, of course. But she said it needs to be channeled toward a one goal. All the, because there was a five components that came out of the book, mental health being one of them, early child marriage being one of them, gender-based violence. And she said, you need to have a cause and you need to channel toward one thing. She said, I will help you set up a nonprofit organization. We were on tour in Kenya and she helped us do this while we were on tour. And that's how it happened.
Okay, now let's get into your book. I Am My Mother's Wildest Dream has resonated with a lot of people. You've garnered a lot of support. And it's touched a lot of people in ways that many books haven't before. What was the inspiration behind the title and the book? What made you want to do something like this?
It's a really good question. I know I'm a very honest person. I'm a very open person. But at the same time, I'm very reserved about my life. Because, you know, as a self-to-me, we're all raised that our issues or they all stay in the house, right? Nothing come outside, especially for women. I went through the early child marriage over 20 years ago. Never talked to anybody about it. In fact, I have one colleague, one friend from the military. She was she's from Syria and she's a pharmacist and she knows my story and I know hers. And she told me, she said, don't share with anybody because they will not understand your culture or my culture. These American people don't understand and they're just going to laugh. So I never shared my story with anyone. Plus, it seemed like it's every spouse with a new story, especially the girls. And, you know, you guys have, boys have their own problem as well. But for girls, my story relate to them. And it just seemed mundane, right? It's just everybody's problem. We're all refugees. If you're a young girl in Africa, you probably went through arranged marriage, things like that. So it was never really interested for me to share, you know? But what happened in 2020, I don't know if you were still in America or in South Sudan at the time when the South Sudanese young women started speaking up about some of the challenges they face on a daily basis here in America and all over the world. That was my inspiration. I went on that page called South Sudanese Women Love. I give them encouragement. I uplift them. I share my background as a medical personnel, talk about informed consent when it comes to rape, talk about depression, anxiety. So I was really being a mentor to them, and I saw the need or the calling to actually share my own story and not just talk to them about facts and statistics and how to help themselves, but to actually open up to them and say, I can also relate to you. So when I opened up to them about my own little glimpse of life and said, I too had an arranged marriage, I had a flock of women calling me and asking me how I can help them and things like that. So they were my inspiration. When I wrote the book, I thought it was for them. I was writing it for these young women and I was encouraging them to say, you too can share your story. Your story is not your fault. You know, you can talk about it openly. You own your story. And if you open up about it and talk about it and accept it, then you can move on from there and you can find healing. So that was the inspiration. It was a very group of intimate women from South Sudan all over the world that I was opening up to, not knowing that I just opened my whole life to the whole world.
One of the things with people like yourself, who you think that, okay, what I'm writing is something small and it's going to impact a small audience. But one of the things that you've done, and I don't think you realize this, is that you've inspired people to reflect on their challenges and you've given somebody hope. When somebody reads your story, and hey, listeners, go get the book. We're going to share too many details from coming from the refugee camp, the mental health issues, the different things that you've dealt with in your life. A lot of people go through that. Not only what you went through exactly, but a lot of people went through the challenges of being a refugee, the challenges of coming to America, the challenges of internal domestic and family challenges that we've seen. And we've been taught, okay, you keep this to yourself. So when you tell your story, in a way, you've inspired many people than the small group you intended to inspire. You've inspired a lot of people across the country to really get into themselves and see how they can overcome the challenges in their lives. Because when somebody sees you, too often we look at the surface of things. People see you, you're a nurse, you have real estate, you were in the army, you have a nonprofit. They see you as if your life is perfect, but they don't know what you went through to get where you got to. And this is one of the things that I always tell people, one of the things that inspired me to do this podcast, because I want to get really successful and brilliant people like yourself and hear, how did you get there? What challenge did you overcome? Because when you listen to that, and when somebody sees that she went through that and she got to where she can get to, that's inspirational to them. I can do it too. And that's an indirect inspiration. So that's one thing that I feel as if with writers, because me, I'm a writer. I haven't published a book, but I realize you write something, an article, and the person, your target audience, the people you never intended to reach out to might be inspired. And one of the things that I wanted to say is that what inspired me about this book was the title. Because when you say, I am my mother's wildest dream, you're basically saying that I'm a manifestation of the prayers, of the blessings of my mother. And what more satisfaction can we get in life than to please our mothers? What more do we have than our mothers? And so I resonated because I remember what my mother did to bring us to the U.S., when my mother has the sacrifices they've done and the dreams. I mean, you're just a kid dreaming like you're going to be something great. So now I look at my life, I'm like, wow. This is what you manifested. And so it's like you gave this book, I would say, to mothers. So the audience that you didn't realize it was mothers, and everybody's a child of a mother. So even me, I'm like, wow, what did my mother go through that I didn't know? What are the challenges that I went through? Have there been instances where I haven't been the best, you know, husband or brother or son? It gets you to reflect, because we live in a very patriarchal society. Once again, listeners, this book is very, very harsh and crude. He doesn't hold back. And so that's one of the things I wanted to ask you, like, when writing the book, what allowed you to keep writing? What didn't, like, because did you have a moment where you said, hey, I'm going too much, I need to hold back? Or you're like, I just need to say what I need to say?
I just cried, right? Like, I really just did while you were talking, because I'm thinking about the title and I'm thinking about my mom. We are really the manifestation of our own mother's dreams, you know, their prayers. We are. And as many people who have read my book knows, I did a lot talk about my mom, you know. Yes, the book is, you know, I wrote it and it's about my ideal family. But really, if somebody sit down and really reflect deeply, they would know that I am actually talking about my mother through me. My mother is here in the U.S. She has not read the book because the book is in English, but I would love for her to read it. And all the women, especially the women, the mothers that were in refugee camps, you know, my friends' mothers, that we did the same thing and they did the same for us. I would love them to read this book, because there are instances in that book that were truly, like, they can say, yes, I remember when we went collect these wood for cooking. To answer your question, what really did I went through a challenge time where I felt like I need to stop writing or hold some things back? Yes, I did. I did. And even when the book was finished, I wrote it and I'm like, okay, it's time to send it to the editor. I first sent it to my siblings, all of them. you know, I sent it to my older brother, Quiz, who I respect so much and value his input. And I'm so grateful he encouraged me to publish this book, because without him, this book probably would have still been in my laptop. So I sent it to him and I sent it to my younger siblings. They read it and I told myself, I said, if they disagree with me publishing it, I will not publish it. So even at the end, I was still doubting whether I was going to go forward with it or not, until my brother Quiz told me to publish it. He called me saying, Naichem, he said, I read your book. And he said, go ahead and publish it, because nothing in this book is not true. And we were both really worried about our dad, because my mom had called my brother every single time during the process and said, have you read her book? Have you read what she's saying? What did she say about that? What did she say about us? What did she talk about this story? And my brother was calming my mom down the whole time. And when he read it, he called my mother. He said, Najok did not talk about dad. It's about her life story and what happened. This book is not about dad, and she can publish it. So that's when I had the courage to publish it. But the whole time, I called my dad and I told him that I was sharing my story. And he told me that it has been over 20 years and that I need to let it go. And if I keep holding on to this one thing, and he was talking about the arranged marriage, he said, if I keep holding on to this, it's going to impede me from moving on and having a very happy life, because, you know, I'm still living backwards. So when my dad said that, I was just like, you know what? This is my story. This is something that impacted me. If I want to talk about it, I'm going to talk about it. So I called my dad and I said, I finished the book and I want to publish it. I would like you to read it. And my dad said, okay, send it to me. I did not have the courage to send it to my dad. I did not. I put it in an envelope, big envelope. I put it in an envelope and I've never mailed it. I did not. So it was me and my brother Quiz that actually said publish it. And I'm so grateful for him.
Wow. Yeah. That's interesting. And I think one of the things about the book that I think a lot of people, we've never had this type of book within our communities. We never had, I think you're probably the first. People don't write about their lives. We have a lot of political books, too many, but we don't have books that talk about mental health or people's upbringing. And yeah. What I'm learning more and more is people have such unique stories that they should be allowed to tell, because like you said, you're telling the truth. And for those of you who read the book, her brother that said, nothing you said here is true, he's mentioned in the book many times. You have to read it. And so going to the point, another theme in your book is mental health. You talk about the mental health issues that you've seen, and you've seen how our community ignores it. So is that what drove your passion to really get into mental health and prioritize mental health as an issue to advocate for?
The whole inspiration was revolving in mental health from the beginning, because we know it was about race, right? The first audio from Twitter that came out from a Sudanese young woman was, I was raped by a South Sudanese young boy in the community in Omaha, Nebraska. Nobody did anything about it, even though they knew. And then more young girls came up and started naming who raped who and how the family responded when they found out, mom and dad, and hiding it. So everything that started this book was about mental health. And the second theme that, if you read the book, it probably was about arranged marriages of children, of young girls, especially forced arranged marriages. To me, those were a part of my book, but I couldn't just publish the book on those two chapters or those two themes. I needed to make it evolve around what else did I go through. So everything else came after those two main points. So mental health, I talked about my brother's mental health and my own mental health. Chapter 7 in my book was a mental health issue that I was going through at the time I was writing it. And when you read the book, Chapter 7, people put that book down. They said I couldn't pass chapter 7. I had to put it down, go cry, and come back later because it was still fresh. I was still going through it.
You mentioned it quite a bit. In 2022, I lost my brother. He was tragically killed in Iowa. And that's when I really started to focus on mental health. And one of the things that I remember, because I live in South Sudan, so when he was shot, I went to the U.S., I traveled, and then come back. And when I came back, one of my uncles was like, oh, you know, you're not the first person to have a brother that died. And like, this is literally my only brother. And I'm just like, and I went on a very, very rigid journey of mental health. And the first thing I was doing was ignoring it. But I didn't realize how much this can impact me and how much it's going to impact me for a while. So I started reading books about mental health, emotional intelligence, feeling. And one of the best books that I've read is a book called Permission to Feel by Professor Mark Brackett. So touching. It makes you look into that. So when people, like the parts of your books that are the most, I would say, harsh, it's in a way, it's not harsh because it's what's happening in your life now, because you'll be like, what do you mean? Like somebody say, why are you talking about this? Your life is good now. You know, mm-hmm. Those scars are still there. Mm-hmm. Because when writing this, it goes to the point where every moment I would feel like, oh, I've moved on. Something would remind me of it. And one of the things that mm-hmm. I realized I had to do was be honest about my feelings, be honest about how I felt. This thing made me feel a certain way. I felt like, you know, when you lose somebody to that, you feel like you could have been there. I'm the older brother. I should have protected him. I should have done this. Why am I in South Sudan? You know, because I came to South Sudan after I finished college in 2017. Maybe I should have if I was there in his life. These are emotions that we don't process. And how many people out there experienced something that happened in the 90s and 80s till now that haven't processed it? Yeah. And so when you reflect on some of the events in your life, and it'll be something like you'll talk about this happened 15, 20 years ago, but you know, they say you can feel the writer's feelings and the writer's tone. Yeah. In some instances, it was a tone of just reflection. It was a tone of like, I'm still not over this. And I think that was one aspect that really resonated and inspired like me as somebody who, as a reader, I'm like, wow, she is still struggling with these things. And, and you were very honest about it. Some people like will say the story, I'm okay, life is good. And now, you know, mashallah, you've been blessed. You're doing investments. You have your kids. You moved to San Antonio. You bought a new house. We always think like, oh, it's done. You can't. Mm-hmm. Things are still fresh. And I ask myself, how much trauma are we carrying as a South Sudanese community that, and how people that are in their 70s have seen the worst things, death, destruction, everything. Yeah. How much trauma are we carrying? So that was one thing that I really would say that you've helped me to look into, because I'm like, have I overcome some of my own trauma, some of my own things? And am I honest about my mental health? And these are some of the things that's one aspect I feel as if you that's an angle. Cause like as a guy, you probably wouldn't think of like, okay, the target towards mothers or women, but also the mental health aspect. They're throwing it in our face as a South Sudanese community. Face your issues. And that's one thing that I would say about the harshness of your book. I like it. Like we need to have those harsh conversations. We need to express those harsh truths.
You know what, Cole? When it comes to mental health, nobody heals through their trauma by hiding it. Trauma, I read it in one of the books, and I read so many books like what you just mentioned as well. I read all those kind of books too, because I am trying to heal through my trauma. And one of the quotes I read, it says, grief and trauma require a witness. What that means is you have to talk to somebody about those. You're grieving, you have a trauma challenge that you're going through, you have to find somebody to talk to, otherwise you will not heal from it. And our country is a country of hiding trauma, pretending that we're okay. But when a person sit down, whether they have a big house, they got mates, people are cooking for them, they have a V8, when they sit down, they are sitting down with their own thoughts, with their own emotions. Nobody can fix you through those things, no matter how successful you look from the outside. So I was going through so much when I was writing that book, not only about my past trauma were coming back to me, I was also living a current issues at the time, divorcing, mental illness, and being, I felt like I was being kicked out of the army because I was literally healed. So I was losing a career of 11 years. So much was going on, and I didn't feel healed. Guess this, I fell healed during the tour. During the tour, I was on book tour, is when I felt like I was finally healing from my problem. And it's because I was talking about it so much.
And I feel like this, what's so interesting is that it wasn't writing it. It was because at some point, you'd probably reflect on it in a different point of view, where you think about this angle. Or maybe you'd meet somebody who expressed, like now, for example, I'm telling you what maybe I went through. You're like, okay, man, like, you're seeing part of your healing. And I realize it. That's why they always say, there's a saying that in the Alcoholics Anonymous, they say the key to getting cured is to help somebody else. So with everything, that last aspect of helping somebody else, when you like, so when we see you, we already know that, hey, this is a book. We already know what we're getting into. So if somebody comes to you, express themselves, hey, I went through this. And you're like, wow, I'm also helping other people heal. That is also a healing aspect in of itself. It heals you because you're like, wow, I'm healing and I'm helping people heal. I think when you're on tour and you'll meet people you've never met in your life, read your book, who come to you and like, wow, I like this. When you wrote about this, and it's crazy how you'll think like, man, did I say too much? But somebody's like, you said what you needed to be said. Mm-hmm. And so for our listeners, like, this is the challenge. Like, we have trauma. We have a lot of challenges we face. And what are we going to do about it? We have to be honest. And one thing, honestly, I was guilty of this, is that I wasn't talking about what I was going through, and I just had to start reflecting. And I remember I would shut down to the point where even my wife is like, what's going on? Like, you have to talk about it. I'm like, no, I can't talk about it. And mm-hmm. I remember I had to just be honest with myself and be honest with, have a conversation with my family, you know, like, how is this impacting you? And part of it is those hard conversations, you know, those initial conversations that you have to have. Like, number one conversation, you know, to tell yourself, I am not okay, is so difficult. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So difficult, because you're like, but I'm doing well, you know, I go to the gym, I do this. And what happens is, I was reading a book and it talked about how sometimes with trauma, don't fill it with something else. Meaning that if you're going through something, don't do something to forget about the trauma. And so people might, for example, be facing a grief and then they resort to exercise or alcohol or drugs or some activity, not because they want to, because it allows them to forget. Because at the end of the day, when you lay down on your bed, you have to face that. You have to, in your own head, nobody's there. Nobody's gonna help you with that. And so with that, like, I would say, what is the biggest challenge that you've overcome in your life?
Single parenting is probably my biggest challenge. And I say this with all honesty, my daughter's almost 22 and I still cry about raising her. Just thinking about it, like, I looked at her, I'm like, how did I do that? Like, she's such an amazing girl, very respectful, beautiful, doing all the things right. And looking at her, I'm like, I was freaking 16 and I did that. Like, how did I do that? You know? So being a single mother and being a dreamer to have a career and be in college for 4 years, raising a kid and going to the military, I didn't realize that at the time how hard it was. But now, looking back at my age now, I tell you this story and you also see how traumatized I was and still probably have the trauma from it. I was probably 19 years old. And here's my daughter. She was 2 years old. I was going to college in the morning. I worked night shift. And then, you know, we couldn't pay for daycare. She had to be in the house while I try to sleep after school. I go to school in the morning, sleep during the day with a kid in the house. And then I go to work in the evening. So one day I took her, put her in a car seat, I don't know if I was going to work or school, but in any event, I had a child in a car seat. I was so hungry, extremely hungry. I got a pizza from the house and I was carrying a pizza one hand, a kid in the other side, and I was trying to open the door, the car door, to put my daughter in. My pizza fell in the ice. And it was, you know, it was winter. I picked it up and there was ice on this piece of pizza. I tried to get the ice off, couldn't get all of it, and I took a bite, and it was so cold, full of ice, and I started crying. I was hungry. So this event came back in my mind again a couple of weeks ago. I had two boys now, and they are 6 and 7. My daughter is in college, and in the morning, you know, it was a weekend, it was Monday, I was really, really tired, came off 36-hour shift. And I was going somewhere to pick up my kids and I was running late. So I got the food from the kitchen and I got in the car and I started eating in the car driving to go pick up my kids. And at that moment, what had happened almost 20 years ago flashed in my eyes, in my mind, and I parked my car. I said, I'm too old to be doing this. I'm too old to be driving, eating at the same time. I deserve to sit at the table and eat sitting down. I started crying again. I said, I cannot live this life on the go all the time. I shouldn't be almost 40 years old. I shouldn't be driving, eating at the same time because I do not have time to sit down. I said, this got to change. So yes, being a single mother, raising kids alone and working and doing all of that is probably my biggest challenge that I have overcome. But I look at my daughter and I'm like, wow, God did that because definitely it wasn't me.
Yeah, I mean, when you watch your interviews, when you were doing your tour, you're like, yeah, you know, my daughter's 20. And I'm like, wait, that was 2 years. When you say 22, because I'm used, you know, you had your like, my daughter's 20. And then now you say she's 22. I'm like, time goes by. I mean, you know, inshallah, pretty soon you'll be inviting us for, say, hey, you know what? I'm going to be getting married soon. And time will go by. Another thing is that how do you balance all these things? Like, you do a lot. You're on tour. You have kids. You're writing your book. You're a nurse. You've become a very prominent public figure within the South Sudanese global community. How do you juggle all these?
I am so blessed with a very, very supportive friends and family members. That moment during the tour in 2022, 2023, there is no way I would have done what I did without the support system that I had at the time. Now, I don't have that anymore now, and I cry every day. I'm like, how did they do this? How can they just leave me with these kids alone? But I had a very supportive, my sister supported me the whole time, and my ex-husband, Richard, he was amazing with the kids, supporting me and saying, go do the tour, do the book, do, you know, if you want to go travel nursing, you do. He was taking care of the boys. So it's really the support system that I had and my own drive. You know, I'm a very driven person. I write my goals down. I make sure they are accomplished. If I have to skip a meal, I do. If I have to do them while driving, I do. But all of that comes together because I allow other people in my family to support me and help me so I can also get the things that I need to get done.
And it's a time thing. It's just balancing the time. I mean, you're a testament to the argument. They said you'll make the time if you want to do it.
Yeah.
You know, especially when you're younger, you're like, I don't have time. I have all this I'm doing. I have this many classes. I mean, you're over here driving and eating and at the same time and taking care of kids. And, you know, so it's really, really, you know, truly inspiring. One aspect that I want you to share is the entrepreneurship. You talk about real estate. That's one aspect. And you spoke a lot about financial literacy, being debt-free. So maybe this is mostly for our audience in the US, what advice would you have for them to be financially stable, debt-free, and have multiple streams of income?
We can talk about financial literacy all day because it's truly a passion for me. And as many excuses we have here, and you know, I'm not going to talk about the people in Africa and South Sudan because they have their own challenges. Some of them, I don't understand them. I don't even know what most of them are. But for the people in the West, in America, Australia, Canada, Europe, we have so many excuses of why we cannot be financially independent. But those are just excuses, okay? They are just excuses. There are so many resources that are available for anybody that wants that. But again, people have different goals, different priorities, and people do and give time to what is important to them. Mm-hmm. Me being financial independent has always been important to me. We all came with nothing. We all came with nothing, and we came in a place with a lot of things. You get to choose what you want to take back home and what you don't want to take back home. I want to be wealthy by the time I leave this earth. I want my kids to inherit things from me, especially the drive, the resiliency. And I want them to have money, and I want them to learn how to do that, how they can do that. I have goals. I have vision boards in my house, one in my living room or in my media room where we watch TV, and one in my own bedroom. And then I have other goals on my phone. But one of my goals in my bedroom, those are like very personal stuff. You know, I have vacation stuff, you know, going to Africa, which I have done. But these goals, I wrote them years ago. 6 years ago, I wrote that I want to be a millionaire by, I have a certain date. And there is no doubt in my mind that it will happen. Or maybe it already happened. Who knows? So there is no doubt. To pay off my house, it was a goal that I wrote down. To buy a new house, it was a goal. To do this, all of them, even my daughter to go to our college that she went to, those were goals that we wrote down as a family, as individuals. But to live the life that you create in your mind and you want, you have to give up so many other things that you might also like equally, but are competing with each other. For me, I give up a lot of community stuff, you know. I live in San Antonio, Texas, which is 12 hours away from Omaha, Nebraska. There are things in Omaha that I am invited to, that I am wanted to be in every single week. I can't do all of those things if I want to work and have a job and keep my career, pay my house. I can't fly to Omaha every weekend. So I have prioritized which one I need to go to and which one I don't have to go to. Okay? So there are ways to be financially successful. There's roadmap that's already been put together that you just have to follow. But it has to be important to you to walk that road, even if you're walking it alone. So for me, there is no doubt in my mind that financial freedom is something I'm seeking, and it's something that will happen. And, you know, I am living my dream. So it's a goal and it's a plan.
And everything is just planning and the goals. And just touch briefly on real estate. What would you say to somebody who's interested in pursuing a real estate career or doing real estate investments in the U.S.? You said earlier that you have two properties, and congratulations, you just recently bought a house. What would you say to people who are interested, young people in the South Sudanese in the U.S. who want to get into real estate?
I started my real estate venture by reading the book Rich Dad, Poor Dad, How the Rich People Teaches Their Kids That the Poor People Don't. That's the title of the book. Mm-hmm. And then I move into learning about taxes, the taxation, how rich people actually build their wealth. So in order for somebody to get into the real estate, I would say learn as much as you can. Sometimes learning on the job is the best. But maybe you start by grabbing that book by Robert Kiyosaki, Rich Dad, Poor Dad. When I read that in 2015. By 2016, I started going into conferences, real estate conferences. 2017, I purchased my first investment property, which I flipped. I fixed and I flipped it, sell it again. I did a total of 4 houses that I did the same way. Buy them, fix them, and sell them. And then now, you know, I'm holding this one. So I would say by doing that, read the book, find a mentor. Don't do it like the way I did. I spent $60,000 on a real estate mentorship. You don't have to do that. You can find somebody that's already doing it at the community and follow them. We have a guy here in U.S. His name is Galois. He flips home in Rochester, New York, or maybe Buffalo, New York. He's in New York. He flips home, and he's not the only one that does that. There's plenty. Contact them, shadow them, do one house with them. We have 2 young boys in Omaha, Nebraska, the dead brothers. They fix homes. They have real estate business. Follow them, see what they do, learn from them. This is how we teach each other, you know, learn on the job. But start reading that, you know, as you learn about building wealth and becoming financial freedom, you know, the way that rich people build wealth is really through real estate income that comes with our new, yeah, real estate is the way to build wealth. You know, you see McDonald's, you see all these restaurants, they are real estate. They're not McDonald's, they're not just food. This is a real estate. I would highly encourage it. For me, I have a big land in Yuba that hopefully one day I will get to build. And maybe it'll be hotels. Maybe it'll be, you know, I don't know, apartments. But that's real estate. And one day, maybe I'll have your name on it. So I love real estate.
What are some words of inspiration that you have for our listeners, particularly the youth of South Sudan, all around the world?
I don't have anything inspirational. you say earlier, like somebody looked at me and say, hey, Nyajok have it all figured out, you know, successful, she's this. It might look like that. It might really does, you know, and I do have, you know, we're talking about material stuff. I do have those things, but personal challenges are there no matter what, but we have to go through them. We have to go through them. The things that allow us not to sleep at night, we have to wake up in the morning and still do what we really need to get done. So for those young people in South Sudan, I would, you know, and I say this, have a vision of your life. Know where you want to take your life. And anything that deters you from that vision, it's not worth it. Because as soon as you start following other people's vision for you, which there's plenty of people in our own family, in our friends, in the country that want to tell you who you should be and how you should live your life. But if you have a clear vision of how you want your life to be, follow it. There are plenty of people that will help you get there. Most of people that are successful or living their own dreams didn't get there by themselves. There's always somebody that wants to pick you up, take you to the next level, and somebody else will take you from there, and somebody else will take you to the next level. So these people are there, but you have to have an idea of where you want to go, and then God put them on your path. That's all I would say, is that know who you are, know where you want to go, and then things will fall into their place.
Know who you are, know where you want to grow, and things will fall into their places. Ladies and gentlemen, those are wise words from our beloved sister Nyajo. Thank you for sharing your insights and your experiences. As always, guys, you can find the book, I Am My Mother's Wildest Dream. It's on Amazon, right? Amazon.
I still have 1,200 books in South Sudan right now that need to be delivered to different states, because those books were donated for all of our 10 states plus the 3
administrative areas.
3 administrative area. So 1,300 books that were purchased by Tukal, and only one state, Lake State, is the only state that picked up their 100 books. All the different states have not picked up their books. And if they need them, which I get contact on a daily basis from people from Unity State, people from Malakal. They want books. They have books. their education, a minister of education, need to get a hold of me and pick up their book in Juba.
You guys have heard that, and they can find you on social media.
Yeah, Nigel Tommy, they'll find me on social media.
So if you're in the West and have access to Amazon, find this book on Amazon. It's on Kindle if you want the ebook, and anywhere they sell books. If you are in South Sudan or East Africa, contact Nyajok and she'll explain to you how you can get your book. Yeah. Thank you, Nyajok, for joining us for the conversation and having such an enlightening episode.
Thank you. Thank you also for having me.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, that's it. I love you guys. Have a blessed day and always stay true.